This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Tuesday in Toronto, the National Hockey League met with representatives of the NHL Players Association and presented a collective bargaining counterproposal to which the players turned up their battered noses. There are no more meetings scheduled, leaving observers to wonder not if but when the National Hockey League regular season will be canceled. Joining me now on the line from her cushy Los Angeles, formerly hockey lair, is Helene Elliott. Hi, Helene.
Cushy?
Well, I assume so.
On a newspaper salary?
This is radio. We can say anything we want. Don't let the cat out of the bag. Anyway, NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman said on Tuesday that last Thursday's offer by the union of a 24% salary rollback was, quote, a big-time, significant, and meaningful move. But then he went on to say that it wouldn't be enough to cure the league's long-term financial troubles. Why not?
Yeah, I love how he praises them and then he trashes them in the next breath. This is all a lovely game called negotiation. And believe it or not, I actually do agree with Commissioner Bettman on this one to an extent. I think that the player's offer of the 24% salary cut was very much a public relations move. I know it was a real move. It was going to hurt people in the wallet, but they phrased it in a way that people can understand. I mean, the average sports fan doesn't know a luxury tax from a salary cap. And, you know, it's just so complicated. You know, the NBA, they talk about mid-level exceptions and this and that. But when you state something as a 24% salary cut, everybody can understand that. It's just plain English. You get 24% less of your salary. I think the players' union was trying to win public favor that way. But the one thing that they didn't account for was that there's something like 200 unsigned players right now. And those players would not be subject to a 24% cut. Plus, there are a lot of players whose contracts expire in a year or two or three. And don't you think that there are some owners out there who are stupid enough to sign them to huge money contracts and start this whole spiral all over again?
Nashville Predators forward Jim McKenzie said this week that, quote, basically the league has taken our 24% rollback, put it in their pocket and said thank you as though it were some kind of tip, and then said now we'll negotiate and we'll go back to getting this cap. Is that an accurate perception, or should McKenzie and the rest of the players have known what would come?
I think they should have known that this was only going to be a start. I mean, there have been no real serious negotiations, no real serious proposals until the last week or so. And I think that you have to realize nobody's going to accept the first proposal that's thrown out there. I think this is going to keep going until the very last minute, which would be, even though Commissioner Bettman won't put a date on it, I would say just common sense says this is going to go until maybe January 15th or so. And that's going to be the real cutoff date in order for them to play 48 games or 45 games or anything that's even a semi-meaningful season.
Some hockey followers have recently asserted that the ongoing lockout is essentially the result of a personality clash between Gary Bettman and Players Association head Bob Goodenow. Is that another example of oversimplification?
I think it is. I think what it really comes down to is that when Gary Bettman was hired to take over as the NHL's commissioner in 92-93, his whole job was to get a salary cap in the negotiations of 1994-95. He didn't get that salary cap. And the agreement that he walked away with, initially people were saying, wow, Bettman and the league, they really hoodwinked the union. Well, it took agents and it took players and it took stupid owners only a couple of years before the entire agreement turned around and it worked to favor players. You know, I discount those ideas of a personality clash. I think that these are people who are working for their constituents, for the people who pay them. And in Bettman's case, that's the owners. And obviously in Goodenow's case, that's the players.
Is there any indication that the reason things haven't been settled is because maybe the owners wanted things to go this badly and want to lose this season, that being the only way they'll regain control?
I think that's partially true. I think that Bettman is very intent on impressing players with the seriousness of this. There seems to be a whole attitude of the sacredness of a season, and particularly I was just up in Toronto for the negotiations and the responses and all, and it seems like, you know, people are so aghast at losing the season, capital T, capital S. And Bettman has very clearly stated that it's not about when you get the deal, it's about getting the right deal. He's not looking at just the short-term idea of you know, breaking up record books and players whose careers might be over if there's no season this year. He's looking at what he thinks is the long-term interests of this league. And with TV revenues down, with so many other revenues down, it's clear that this league cannot support the kind of salaries that it had been paying out.
All manner of predictions have come. What happens if the season is lost? Everything from can the National Hockey League survive to how many teams will be lost. What do you think the best guess is for the result of this if the season doesn't happen?
You know, I'm among those who say that the league would not suffer so horribly if there were fewer teams. But then you get into the argument of which teams go. And if you take a team that didn't draw well last season, that's not fair because all these things go in cycles. You know, some teams will draw well and do well for a season or two, and then they'll go in a downturn. But it's going to be interesting to see how this league comes out of this. I think that if they do not solve it in January, and if Bettman tries to impose labor conditions, if they try to declare an impasse and he tries to implement a salary cap, then you get into really nasty legal fights. And by the time that's all resolved, I would not be surprised if this league comes back with maybe four or five teams gone.
Helene Elliott covers hockey for the L.A. Times. She's only a Games Lady Lockout, and when there is hockey, she's our scribe of the skate sharpener. Happy holidays, Helene.
You too.
The National Basketball Association may soon need to rename itself. After all, the league now employs 81 international players. They're true globetrotters who hail from 35 countries, including Belize, Croatia, France, and Haiti. Besides the United States, the country most well represented is Serbia-Montenegro. On November 21st, Nancy Greenlease of member station KUNC in Greeley, Colorado, attended a game between the multinational Denver Nuggets and Dallas Mavericks, and she has this report on the foreign invasion of the NBA.
Sweat glistens on Denver Nuggets forward Nikola Skitishvili and the man guarding him, Dallas Mavericks center DJ Benga. Skitishvili lands a perfect jump shot, but it will be his only one of the night because Benga, the young Congolese, refuses to let down his guard on the quick-footed forward from the Republic of Georgia. Some 34 years after the first foreigners were drafted by NBA teams, the 7-foot Skitishvili, a former dancer, is gracing the Nuggets stage. He's earned his ravest reviews lately from American NBA players, still amazed at how much of the basketball world outfoxed them at the Athens Olympics.
They've been saying, like, wow, man, you guys can shoot. You guys were on the fire. I mean, make all the shots. You know, that's what European players like, shoot all the time. 6 hours in a day.
Increasingly, these foreign-born players are making a mark in the NBA. German Dirk Nowitzki is averaging more than 25 points a game for the Mavericks. Spaniard Pau Gasol is putting up double digits for Memphis. But although team play and solid fundamentals are welcome in the league, Dallas Mavericks assistant coach Del Harris says foreign players can expect big changes if they are to adjust to the NBA.
Actually, we're trying to eliminate their style, in fact.
This is particularly the case with Chinese players, says Harris. 3 years ago, Dallas drafted the first Chinese player, Wang Zhuzhu, who paved the way for Houston Rockets center Yao Ming. But before the 7-foot-6-inch Ming became an all-star, he was a gentle giant, not nearly physical enough to survive the NBA. It's a culture clash that Harris encountered this year when he coached the Chinese national team.
They were thinking, well, we're not emotional, we're not physical, we're not aggressive. And I said, well, that's fine in your particular culture, but if you're going to compete in the international culture of basketball, that's a separate culture, and you have to separate that from who you are, you know, as a regular person. And it doesn't make you bad or anything like that. You just have to adjust.
One of the most difficult adjustments is learning a new language. Players are slow to respond to coaches' commands when they have to be translated into three languages. For the Mavericks, DJ Benga, English is coming easily. But according to Del Harris, Benga is still adjusting to American culture.
The girls. He can't believe it. He thinks he's in paradise.
What about those girls?
Well, apparently they're quite friendly to this young fellow, and he thinks it's a good thing.
When asked about women, 19-year-old Benga exhales and confesses that this is a big problem. Benga, who grew up watching fellow Congolese Dikembe Mutombo, realizes that he has an entire country and continent watching him. He says the Congo could provide more prospects.
First, we have so many players, so many talent, so many athletes. So we now have the gym, we have the ball. Some guy maybe he needs some shoes for play. He needs shorts. He needs everything.
The NBA's Basketball Without Borders program has poured money into Africa and other parts of the world to provide courts and training. Still, most foreign players are pretty raw when they arrive on these shores. In fact, only 8 of the 58 foreign players drafted in the last 3 years played college basketball. Until recently, Nikolo Skidishvili sat on the bench most games, which frustrated him.
Yeah, a little bit, because, you know, I'm loving the game, so I wanted to play. But also I understand that I was not really ready for it. For example, you know, I might have skills, but you, mentally you're not really ready, you know, to concentrate and focus on the game, whatever coach wants.
At time for two, Nene!
Brazilian center forward Nene is averaging about 5 points and 4 rebounds per game for the Nuggets. He says he's assimilated to one aspect of the game, trash talk.
You know, everybody talking.
Well, what language do you do it in?
Me? I don't know. You know, sometimes English, sometimes Portuguese. These guys understand. It's good. This is my advantage.
If the current trend continues, more and more players will understand Nene's Portuguese expletives. NBA scouts are covering the globe with new emphasis on Japan and the Far East. Some mock NBA drafts have projected that 15 of the 60 picks in 2005 will be international players. For Only a Game, I'm Nancy Greenlease in Denver.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. The Vatican's attempt to make the Catholic Church more relevant to the young has led to the creation of a sports department and to a weekly program devoted to soccer on the Vatican's radio network. The show is disseminated across Italy and features cardinals commenting on soccer. In the program's initial broadcast, 88-year-old Cardinal Fiorenzo Angelini criticized Marcello Lippi, the coach of the Italian national team, for choosing players who'd performed well in the past rather than giving new talent a chance. I understand that Italy is a Catholic country, Coach Lippi replied, but now we've got cardinals talking out. I'm having a hard time understanding this. Hey, Coach, it's simple. Your guys got bounced out of last summer's European Championships in the first round. Make some changes, for goodness sake. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the little college in Vermont that can and does, especially on the rink, the track, the courts, and the slopes. But first, on Tuesday night, the District of Columbia Council voted 7-6 to approve legislation that would finance construction of a new ballpark for the former Montreal Expos. The only catch is that said legislation was also amended to require private financing for at least half the stadium's $440 million construction costs, which is not exactly what D.C. Mayor Anthony Williams or Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig had counted on when they reached their initial agreement back in September. Here to help make sense of the D.C. dust-up is ESPN's Tim Kirkchen. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Well, I'm okay, but how are you, a Washington guy? How did Major League Baseball and the District of Columbia and the former Expos get into a situation in which nobody knows whether that team will be playing in D.C. after all?
Bill, the senator, I was 14 years old when the senators left. I started to cry when we found that out. Now I waited 33 years to get a major league team, and they're going to stay here for 3 months, and then they're going to leave. I'm going to cry again. This is ridiculous.
All right, now you're overstating,
okay,
right?
I am overstating. I'm partly kidding. Here's where we are, Bill. The city council, for some reason, at 11 o'clock at night, decided to change the entire plan, violating the entire agreement that had been worked on for months and months and months between baseball and Washington, D.C. This throws the whole situation into this colossal mess, which could cost baseball in Washington for 2005 and years beyond that. I, however, am going to take the high road on this and say, so much work has been put into this situation, so much time with the relocation committee and everybody else. They have 2 weeks, basically, to get themselves together on this baseball, city council, city of Washington, and figure this thing out. And I think they will. I think they'll play here next year. I think they'll play here long term because, Bill, as much as anything else, I can't find any place else for the Expos to play next year. To me, this is the only option. Everyone understands that, and they're going to have to work it out.
Well, I'm sure a place could be found, but perhaps not on short notice. The only alternative might be to barnstorm.
Well, that's a possibility, Bill, but as you know, it's anything beyond, I mean, the schedule is already out.
Absolutely.
Thought of going back to Montreal, where they haven't done anything, and nor should they, for the last 3 or 4 months. The thought of telling Las Vegas, hey, we're coming your way next year, get that 9,000-seat stadium ready for a major league team, that's just not going to work. That's why I believe this is a giant game of chicken now between Major League Baseball, City Council, City of Washington, and they're all have to get together and see who's bluffing. But in the end, they're going to have to negotiate some sort of an agreement here. Otherwise, baseball has a headache on its hands like it hasn't had in a long time.
Which is saying something when you're talking about baseball.
Absolutely.
On to personnel matters, Tim. How much better are the Mets with Pedro Martinez, and how much worse are the Red Sox for his departure?
Well, I think the Mets are much better with him. I'm frankly amused by how many people are calling this the worst signing ever. It's way too much money. I understand all of that, that 4 years, $53 million is too much for Pedro Martinez. But, Bill, we're talking about the Mets here. They were terrible last year. They're trying to compete in New York with the Yankees. They're trying to make their team much better. Along comes a Hall of Famer who just won a World Series ring, has some real swagger, might put some people in the seats, and is still a well above average major league pitcher and the best pitcher on the Mets staff. I don't understand in the short term how this is a bad thing. This is only a good thing for the Mets. Now they have to surround him with some hitters, and then they'll have a chance to be maybe even a contender in that division. The Red Sox unquestionably will be hurt in their pitching by losing Pedro Martinez. I understand he was kind of a pain in the neck to deal with. He was a high maintenance guy who needed to be coddled and protected. He still won 16 games and struck out 9.4 run batters per nine innings, and they will miss him unquestionably.
The Yankees signed free agent pitchers Carl Pavano and Jarrett Wright, and it looks as if they'll get Randy Johnson once all the dust is cleared. Who matches New York's pitching in the American League East, or in the American League for that matter?
Well, I'm not sure anybody in the American League can match the Yankees pitching with Randy Johnson. I mean, the Yankees made an effort the minute they got knocked out by the Red Sox, understanding they lost because their starting pitching wasn't good enough. They said, we're going to improve it no matter what. They signed Jarrett Wright. They overpaid for him. They went out and probably overpaid for Carl Pavano, and then they got Randy Johnson, who's arguably the best pitcher in the game still. He's obviously a first-ballot Hall of Famer and will retire at worst as one of the three greatest left-handers ever to pitch, and they will put him at the top of the rotation, and it will make their rotation as good, if not better, than any rotation in the American League. And to go with the great offense they have and some of the other pieces they have, the Yankees got significantly stronger this winter.
What else does the impatient Mr. Steinbrenner do?
Well, he hasn't even, Bill, gotten to Carlos Beltran yet, who is the best everyday player on the free agent market. They have, and I think correctly so, really concentrated on their starting pitching. Fix that first, then figure out the rest. And the fact that Beltran is still out there tells me that the Yankees are going to wait till the end. They have the most money. They have the most chips. And I think they're going to go in and make a strong bid for him once they get their pitching straightened out. They just have to hope that Beltran doesn't go to the Astros or the Cubs or somebody else by that time.
At least at this point, it seems to me that no team has improved itself any more than the Seattle Mariners have. Would you agree with that?
The Mariners have done some really good things here, Bill. They were a terrible offensive team last year. They got no production from first base, even less production from third base, and they went out and got two players, Richie Sexton and Adrian Beltre, who give them a middle of the order that is demonstrably better than it was last year. They had to do that in order to try to get back in contention and get some people interested again in Seattle. However, I still don't think they're going to contend strongly, at least in that division. because all the money they spent on Sexton and Beltre left them without enough money to go get a quality starting pitcher. They made a really good run at Carl Pavano. They missed out on him. Ideally for them, they would have gotten Pavano and one of the sluggers, not two. But now they don't have enough money to go get a guy, and they're either going to have to get a veteran on the cheap or they're going to have to throw their kids out there. And I think either way, they're not going to be able to contend in this division that way.
The Atlanta Braves are apparently rebuilding according to a plan that's worked for them in the past. Occasionally, it doesn't seem quite fair that a team with as much pitching as Atlanta always has should get Tim Hudson, too, does it?
It sure doesn't seem fair. And it amazes me, Bill, that roughly a week ago, there you looked at their starting rotation and said, boy, they're in a lot of trouble. And now you look at it, and it's really good. It's so good, John Schuerholz now says, the general manager, that it's the best pitching that the Braves have ever had. I respectfully disagree. They had five 15-game winners in 1998. But they added John Smoltz and Tim Hudson, two potential 20-game winners, to the top of their rotation in the last week. They took Smoltz from the bullpen, and they got Tim Hudson from Oakland, and they did it without giving up a core player from their major league team. That was an astounding deal and typical of John Schuerholz, who's as good as there is at swinging a big deal.
Tim Kirchen waxes sometimes poetic and always enthusiastic about baseball for ESPN and on occasion for Only a Game as well. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
It's not necessarily news when an academically strong college or university fields an NCAA championship athletic team. Duke has claimed many a basketball title. Stanford has excelled at baseball. The men and women of Harvard hockey have won recent championships. And now Middlebury College is racking up the sports hardware while honoring its long-standing academic reputation. Ron Schachter recently visited the Middlebury campus, and he has this report.
Middlebury College has thrived for two centuries in the shadows of northern Vermont's Green Mountains, and it's long been famous for its foreign language programs and its English department. Poet Robert Frost had a cabin just miles away and visited the campus from time to time.
Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler.
But over the past decade, Middlebury has distinguished itself on the playing field as well. Since the school started participating in postseason play in 1994, it's captured 22 NCAA championships.
Dorian the side of the net, shot over, score, and it was Tom Maldonado streaking in from the left side, and Doria fed him with a perfect pass.
Last year alone, the Panthers claimed five national crowns in women's cross-country and lacrosse, men's tennis, and both women's and men's hockey. Along the way, the school has become king of the NCAA's Division III, and its more than 400 member schools. Bill Beeney has coached the men's hockey team to six NCAA titles.
The big difference is the fact that most of our athletes know that they're not going on to pro careers. I think with a lot of the Division I athletes, the aspirations are that the college process is just a stepping stone to the pros. So I think that our players play every bit as hard. They prepare every bit as hard as any of the Division I athletes. But I think it's with that little different twist that it is part of their college experience and not the focal point.
Division III schools are usually smaller than their Division I counterparts. Middlebury has about 2,300 undergraduates. Their sports teams get less publicity and play shorter seasons, and they don't offer athletic scholarships. Still, Middlebury is attracting an increasing number of student athletes. Senior Marissa Colley is the captain of the cross-country team, which followed up last year's title with a second-place finish in the 2004 championship last month.
It's intense, but we're not practicing till we drop. If you're running at a D1 program, you're pretty much guaranteed to get injured if you're running twice a day, every day, you know, early in the morning and late at night, which is what often happens. So our team is strong and has been strong over the years because our coaches have always emphasized the fun of it along with the competition.
For Colley's classmate, hockey captain Brian Finney, the chance to play varsity lacrosse as well was just part of Middlebury's appeal.
It's a small school, and so you know almost everybody here, and there's a lot of support. After a game, people will say, nice game, and you know they were watching, and a lot of the events, you know, you see everybody there. So I think that's a lot of it, too, is that people care.
Given the climate in Vermont, you might expect Middlebury to excel only at winter sports. The college runs its own ski area, and the ski team regularly finishes in the top 10 of NCAA Division I, where it tangles with heavyweights Vermont, Utah, and Nevada. But sports like cross country, tennis, and field hockey, in which Middlebury has had to outdistance hundreds of other Division III competitors, have given the school a dominating year-round presence. One key to that success, says athletic director Russ Riley, is a coaching staff that understands Middlebury's academic mission. The average SAT score of this year's freshman class is 1,430.
There are a lot of good X's and O's people out there, but our people have a tremendous job of keeping things in a proper perspective, teaching intrinsic values of sport, teaching life lessons. Probably 35 to 40% of our coaches are Middlebury graduates, so they understand our institution.
Senior lacrosse captain Caitlin McCormick has seen that balance firsthand.
Our coaches are very understanding about what we need to do in terms of meeting our academic requirements, but we also have great professors who are very understanding about athletic commitments and, you know, leaving class early for a game or having to move an exam for playoffs or something like that.
Middlebury's athletic success has bred success in recruiting new generations of student athletes and new waves of alumni contributions. The school has added a new pool, indoor tennis courts, and a $17.5 million hockey complex. That's left Riley and his staff to guard against overzealous recruiting as well as unrealistic expectations on the part of boosters and parents. But for now, the school seems destined for more success. Its men's and women's hockey teams started the season atop the Division III standings and are favored to win two more NCAA titles. Caitlin McCormick, meanwhile, is looking ahead to next spring's lacrosse season.
The weather conditions are pretty harsh here. I mean, we're starting lacrosse going outside in February out on the turf, and they're plowing the snow off for us to get out there. As my coach would say, there's no such thing as bad weather, only inappropriate clothing.
For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Middlebury, Vermont.
Coach lost his head and got off on alligators. Somebody's leaving peanuts on the cabins for a white elephant. Escape from the zoo with love. Girls to show what a moon can do. Moonlight on the mind.
You're listening to Only a Game. From Bremerton, Washington to Barnard, Vermont, there were howls of dismay and impatience this week. It seems that the Only a Game website was not quite up to all the visits it received from people anxious to acquire various wonders featured on our annual gift guide in last week's program. For example, Daniel Field, who hears the program on Vermont Public Radio, wrote to ask for, quote, information about the organization that sells the baseball cards of Jewish players. All necessary information for ordering the baseball cards, as well as the $65,000 diamond-encrusted basketball shoe, is now on our website, onlyagame.org. And Michael Feldberg of the American Jewish Historical Society still swears he can manage overnight delivery, even though Hanukkah is over. Jordan Engel, another Vermont Public Radio listener, also had the gift guide on his mind when he wrote to warn the folks who developed the mailboxes shaped like football helmets against expanding their product line in a particular direction. There's a game some people of questionable morals play here in the sticks, mailbox baseball, he wrote. They drive along country roads and swing at mailboxes with baseball bats, knocking the mailboxes as far as they can. If the firm that makes the football helmet mailboxes is thinking of making them in the form of baseballs, you might suggest that it wouldn't be a big seller. Following last week's acknowledgement of Notre Dame's very good women's basketball team, Mamie Anthoyne Nye emailed to say, quote, thanks for the mention of Notre Dame. We need all the positive publicity we can get these days. Ms. Nye also wanted us to know that Notre Dame's women's soccer team won the NCAA championship last week. Quote, North Carolina can feel Notre Dame breathing down their necks now, she wrote. and that a team of five MBA students from Notre Dame recently won a product strategy case competition held at Duke University, where, as I understand it, the quality of basketball is also pretty fair. Only a Game's email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can also reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Letters and postcards should be sent to Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. And from dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with Hana Yasmin Ali about the book she has co-written with her dad, Muhammad Ali. But first, here to discuss the week's news is Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It turns out that you were right last week when you said that the 24% reduction in labor costs offered by the players would not tempt the NHL to restart the Zambonis. End of story?
I think end of story for at least a year. I mean, if you look at the counterargument made by the league, you know, the proposal will, in 3 years, cost us $11 billion. So we can't possibly make any motion toward having a season if we don't get a salary cap. The important thing to remember is when you're arguing a salary cap, you're not arguing economics. You're arguing control. Who will control where the players play? And that's what the owners want. The figures are as spectral and meaningless as they are in any sports labor dispute.
Pedro Martinez moved from the Red Sox to the Mets this week. The Red Sox also learned that Curt Schilling doesn't think he'll be ready to pitch on opening day. But no problem, Boston acquired David Wells and John Halama. Long live the dynasty, right?
Yeah, there's no question. If you're going to win the first World Championship in eight decades, there's going to be a little bit of leeway in what you're doing in the offseason. But so far, the Red Sox have gone out of their way to create a third-place team.
All the week's free agent signings aside, Charlie, and there have been numbers of interesting ones, I guess the baseball question of the day is, where will the Washington Nationals play next season?
Havana! My dream lives! The Havana Expos. I don't know what was going on in Washington. I don't have any idea how they thought that they would possibly get a fully publicly financed stadium through any politician with a pulse. But apparently the skids were greased until Linda Kropp and the Washington City Council decided there wasn't enough grease in the tracks. And now Major League Baseball has moved into pure blackmail mode.
Well, not only pure blackmail mode, but pure fantasy mode. How do you create a situation? There must be plenty of blame to go around on this.
First of all, let's basically blame Mayor Anthony Williams for thinking that bringing in a baseball team and building a publicly financed stadium will in any way alleviate any of the serious problems he has to deal with as mayor of Washington, D.C. I don't care how far in the tank the Washington Post is. It simply was a bad idea. Major League Baseball went ahead. I have a feeling that a lot of people who could affect this thing weren't consulted, including the neighbors who were going to lose their businesses and homes when they dropped the ballpark down. And now, at the last minute, the D.C. City Council has done something they probably should have done a year ago.
On Wednesday, Olympic track star Marion Jones filed a defamation lawsuit against Balco president Victor Conti, who called the lawsuit, quote, a PR stunt. Could it be that they're both correct?
I don't know. I mean, this is one of those lawsuits which I think you file so that you can, in a couple of weeks, say I filed a lawsuit and I'm defending myself. Does Marion Jones really want to go through, again, in every lawsuit of this kind, the first thing in your mind has to be, does the person filing it really want to go through the discovery procedure? If they don't want to go through the discovery procedure, then the lawsuit's a fake. And I have a feeling that's what this is.
An allegedly important heavyweight fight in Las Vegas last Saturday drew so little interest that the promoters ended up giving away most of the tickets. Charlie, is boxing finally dead? I'm rooting for the answer, a positive answer here.
No, boxing is not dead as long as there are people who work in the kitchens in Las Vegas who are willing to take the cheap tickets and go see the fight. The heavyweight division is on its last legs. Any athletic guy the size of a heavyweight has better things to do with his athletic talent than go into boxing. I don't think the heavyweight division can ever recover. It is a staggering vista of complete bums out there now, of which Vitaly Klitschko, the alleged star of this unsellable fight, is only one.
The Peyton Manning infomercial continues tomorrow night when Indianapolis faces Baltimore. Will Manning get the three touchdown passes he needs to break Dan Marino's season record of 48?
This is actually an interesting game because it's the first decent defense that Peyton Manning has played against since he played against the Patriots on opening night. I don't think Baltimore wants to be the defense that he breaks the record against, and that will enliven things a great deal, I believe.
One down and 28 to go in the college bowl season, Charlie. Were the record books thrown out after Wednesday's New Orleans Bowl?
Yes, the Eagles of Southern Mississippi finished their season at 7-5 with a 31-10 thrashing of the University of North Texas, which I liked a lot better when it was North Texas State when Mean Joe Green went there. And Michael Boley was your first bowl season MVP, a linebacker for Southern Mississippi.
Good on him, say I. It was reported this week that tennis phenom Anna Kournikova has wed singer Enrique Iglesias. Is this because there's no lockout on fabulous entertainers?
Any comment from Senor Iglesias as to whether they're married? Because the wire service story I have only has Anna Kournikova saying that they're married. Is Enrique aware of this? I'll tell you one thing though. I mean, this is a man who clearly plotted out his love life based on the NHL lockout.
Apparently, in an effort to steal some of hockey's thunder, the U.S. Soccer Federation is threatening to use replacement players in some upcoming World Cup qualifiers. Good strategy for raising soccer's profile, eh?
All right, listeners out there, I'm going to make Bill's head explode now. If U.S. Soccer uses replacement players, how are they going to tell?
Mexican soccer standout Maribel Dominguez is making plans to play for a men's side in Mexico, and German star Brigitte Prinz is thinking over an offer to play for Perugia, also a men's team in Italy's Serie A. Publicity stunts or a way to strengthen the two teams?
Well, you would know whether or not these two women can compete much better than I. I would think that at some levels of soccer they could. There is apparently no rule against it, which is, I'm sure, causing some real problems in Serie A. You know, I think it's, you know, probably part publicity stunt and part publicity stunt.
Charlie, last week we talked about the controversial nativity scene at Madame Tussauds Wax Museum in London. It features David Beckham and Posh Spice Beckham as Joseph and Mary, respectively. On Sunday, a protester attacked the wax figures as the spirit of Christmas did.
Well, the interesting thing is that he only attacked Bex and Posh.
Mm-hmm.
He left the Samuel L. Jackson and Kylie Minogue and Hugh Grant and George Bush statue all alone, which leads me to believe, number one, that they didn't ship in the statue of Anna Kournikova in the role of Mary Magdalene yet. And number two, those Arsenal fans really carry a grudge, don't they?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and appears in the Only a Game nativity scene each year as the Heisman Trophy. Thank you, Charlie.
Merry Christmas, Bill. Merry Christmas to everyone.
Toward the end of The Soul of a Butterfly, the new book that Muhammad Ali and his daughter Hana Yasmin Ali have produced, the former heavyweight champion says, quote, "I would like to be remembered as a man who won the heavyweight title three times, a man who tried to unite all mankind through faith and love, and I wouldn't even mind if folks forgot how pretty I was." Hana Yasmin Ali joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Hana, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thank you for having me.
That business about Muhammad not even minding if folks forget how pretty he was is representative, I think. The themes of the book are serious, but there is that sense of Muhammad laughing at himself. So you must have had some fun with the writing.
Oh, yeah. My father, sure, he doesn't take himself too seriously, and I think that's important. You know, he knows how to laugh at himself and, you know, just enjoy himself. And he does enjoy himself, actually. We sit around a lot watching old tapes of himself and footage, and he just says, "I sure was something, wasn't I?" I mean, he'll make you watch the same thing over and over again. If you look away, he'll stop it. You weren't looking. I'm like, "Dad, I've seen it 1,000 times." But it's fun. It's an experience, and I enjoy it.
One of the recurrent themes in the book is that, quote, the importance of life is to accomplish the task we were given, end quote. This comes up several times. Did your father become aware that his task was, as you and he say in the book, becoming an ambassador of peace and love while he was still boxing?
No, my father believes that boxing introduced him to the world so that he could touch so many more people around the world, and his name, to get his name out there so that he could really then, I think, just live as a symbol of peace and love and help the world unite in anything that he could actually help to make the world a better place. So he would say that his life begins at 40, and this is after, what he means by after boxing, my true work began, is that now he can do all the good. He had more time. Now the world knew who he was through boxing is what helped him introduce him to the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's as simply as I can put it.
Now, about halfway through the book, Muhammad acknowledges that he went over the line taunting Joe Frazier back during the time when they were fighting. And that hurt Frazier, and it certainly hurt his family when Muhammad called him an ugly gorilla and referred to him as the white man's champion. He apologizes in the book, and there follows a poem honoring Joe Frazier. Has your father ever extended that apology in person to Joe Frazier?
He has. I know that he has. I could be a little off, but I know that he has said sorry publicly before. And there was a little joking around that because I remember Oprah had come in and did an interview with him and let him know that Joe Frazier had something negative to say to that apology. So his rebuttal was, well, you tell him he's still a gorilla.
Oh.
But here's, you know, and he writes about that. But, you know, it's funny because I think Joe Frazier had said something like, you know, he's the one that can't talk now. And yeah, he's scared. He's hidden and said sorry to me in person, and which I think it's a lot harder to actually do it publicly, really.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that. He delivered that apology when he found out that it did hurt him so much because that was news to him. I mean, people might assume that he knew that Joe Frazier had gone through so much, I think, mentally abuse and turmoil in his kids. I mean, that made him literally just kind of bow his head and shed a tear when he heard that. So, you know, his intention was never to hurt the man. And these are the consequences of his actions. And he's been taking responsibility for that and trying to do something good, I think, to somewhat not make up for it, but just to soothe that pain or just to give something back to him. So I think that hopefully he's accomplished that because it's a beautiful poem.
I wonder if you could read a portion of that poem for us.
There lives a great fighter named Joe, who took his share of blows. They ranged from high to low. He traveled around the globe and walked the long road home. His pain no man could know. There lives a great champion named Joe, who kept his head held high. He fought the best of men and proved his strength would not die. There lives a great man named Joe, who was belittled by a loudmouthed foe. While his rival would taunt and tease, Joe silently bore the stings and then fought like a gladiator in the ring. While Frazier was a man of few words, Ali was a world of mouth. But he found his place in history. Now his heart can express him well. Joe Frazier was a silent warrior whom Ali silently admired. One could not rise without the other.
Muhammad maintains in The Soul of a Butterfly that one of his greatest regrets is turning away from Malcolm X, whom he now regards as a prophet and a visionary. But he mentions other regrets as well. Was that part of the purpose in writing the book, to kind of get those regrets out and all in one place?
No, I think that the purpose of writing the book was just to help people not only understand my father, but to share his experiences, because so many people want to know how it is that he's come to be this person, and they respect him and love him so much. And it's interesting because right now Islam is under attack.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's got a bad name right now, and that pains my father alone because he credits Islam for all of his success. His generosity and his tolerance, his understanding, his patience, he credits to the religion because all he has done is taking the teachings of Islam and to try to live by them. And he really works at trying to be a good person. Like people work to learn certain subjects in school and you study. He studies being a decent person and he practices charity and giving because he knows, he said a million times, you know, God's granted me. People wait on me hand and foot and it's hard to stay humble. So you have to work at it. It is hard. You know, you got people waiting on you, telling you you're the greatest, and you got to remind yourself that you're no better than anybody else. And that's how he raised us, and I'm thankful for that because we were raised with great values and we know what's important in life, and that's what really I think holds you through the tough times when you're, you know, just like for example when he took the stand up against the government and everyone turned their back on him. I mean, he had his spirituality, he had his faith, and he made a funny comment when I was doing the research for this book. I read somewhere that he was at a press conference, and you know, this is when he was down and out, and he was in his second year I think of his exile, and there was a room full of reporters, and he said, you know, if half of you have just one of the problems I have. You'd be trying to jump off a building. Here I am, still smiling and happy and living my life. And he credits it all to his spirituality, his religion, and I think that that's the point, to get so that people can understand him and he can help share those beliefs with the world.
Well, you talk about people learning from stories, and there is a wonderful story at the end of the book, my favorite story in the book, as a matter of fact, about a man who would not accept the money that your father was trying to give him. Tell us that story and tell us a little about the motivations of each character involved.
Okay, the gist of it is, well, we were driving on the way to go buy some Bibles, and we see a man hitchhiking. It's an elderly black man who was on the corner, and he had some Bibles in his hand. We picked him up, gave him a ride. My father, he gets in the back seat. My father turns around so the man sees who he is, and he says, oh, Muhammad Ali. And he was about maybe in his 70s. He told us how he was married to the same woman for, you know, a long time. He's just leaving church, and he said that, you know, he found out we were on the way to go buy Bibles. He offered to give us some when we dropped them off for free, and my dad said, thank you. I want to pay you for them. He said, no, I insist for the ride. I want to pay you back. So here you had two men that are trying to be decent, one by giving and the other by not taking advantage. And it was so interesting because my dad's in the front seat, this guy's in the back seat, and my father asks him how much money he had in his pocket. He said, well, $10. And my dad said, $10, you know. The man said, that's enough. And he said, that's enough for me. He was content with $10. And my dad tells me, you know, he whispers, Hana, go to the ATM so I can only get $300 out at a time. And I drew the money. My father handed it to him in the car. The man says, oh, no, crosses his arm. There won't be none of that going on here. None of that. No, sir. My dad said, take the money, man. Please take the money. The man just would not take the money. So he tries the next step. My father throws the money in the back seat. Now you have to take it. And the man said, Mr. Ali collects the money very quietly. And he says, Mr. Ali, you know, you're a very famous and influential man, but you can't make a man do something he doesn't want to. And I will not take your money. So my father says, oh, take the money, man. I'm trying to get to heaven. And the man says, yes, I'm trying to get to heaven, too. So my father says, if you don't take the money, they might not let me in. And the man says, but if I do take the money, they might not let me in. So it's so funny because then, you know, it was my favorite story, too. That's a perfect example of my father, though. You know, he'll tell you all he wants to do in life really is make as many people happy as he can and get to heaven.
Is that a hard example for you to live up to?
It's challenging, but I wouldn't say it's hard because in nature, I'm a lot like my father and I love people and I like making people happy, probably to a fault almost. It's a challenge. It's always a challenge to be a good person in life because we're here, you know, we're human. But I think that, you know, I was raised hearing these stories and I got to just see the example and it just seems like it's natural. It's just second nature to me. What's hard is for me not to judge other people who might not be at that spiritual understanding or level yet because I compare a lot of other celebrities and people that I meet in the street and I think, well, here's my dad, the most loved, most recognized, most famous man in the entire world. And he's more down to earth than your average person. And it's just amazing. And it's all that does is just make me see how special he is really. And, you know, it just makes me love him more. And it also gives me that, you know, it makes me want to strive to be the best person that I can be. So it's a blessing.
Hana Yasmin Ali wrote The Soul of a Butterfly with her father, Muhammad Ali. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Hana, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Cassius Clay, the most beautiful fighter in the world today. He talks a great deal and brags indeedy of a muscular punch that's incredibly speedy. This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. He is the greatest.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or perhaps learn more about Muhammad Ali's new book, The Soul of a Butterfly, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Soul of a Butterfly co-author Hana Yasmin Ali, who apologized to me for her rather speedy verbal delivery.
Believe me, slow for me is not slow to you.
What'd she say? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Champion of the universe. Don't think me a clown.
but it's just what I want, a heavyweight crown, because I am great, I am the greatest.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.